Okay, so again, well, thank you for coming. Welcome. The plan is that we do some discussion of Srimad Bhagavatam in the form of what I call overviewing. Perhaps first I should introduce myself a little bit, since I'm a strange face around here. I grew up here in the U.S., but I escaped. I found myself in Europe as a young man and met devotees there in Germany. And very shortly after I met devotees, I was taken by them to meet Srila Prabhupada in Paris. And at that time, I was initiated. I had only been with the devotees for about 2 weeks. Here comes the obligatory garland. Thank you. Now I feel so much better. Yes, and that was back in 1972, and then I pretty much stayed on in Europe over the next many years, more than two decades. And then I came back to America to go back to school in California, where I had studied before I went to Europe. And that I mention because that relates to why I'm here now, because we had this conference this last weekend at Harvard on the subject of ISKCON, 50 years of ISKCON. This was an academic conference, so because I've been, mixing with that particular species of human being called academics. There are 400,000 species of human beings, we're told, and one of them is academics. And so I was invited to take part in that. It was a very, very nice conference, I must say, very several scholars, devotee scholars and scholar devotees, I would say. I mean, to say that even those who do not identify themselves as Krishna Bhakta explicitly, they have lots of bhakti and they have a lot of appreciation of our society, and they're all very sincere well-wishers of our society. So it was a very wonderful event. I was especially touched, I would say, by one professor, Thomas Hopkins. He's a real pioneer in the study of our tradition. He wrote his doctoral thesis back in 1962, and his subject was Srimad Bhagavatam. And I asked him, has your thesis ever been published? He said, no, it's just sitting on the shelf. And I proposed to him that maybe we could publish it. We have a little new imprint, a little offshoot from the BBT, which is specifically for academic sort of works on our tradition. So I'm going to see if we can publish that work. But he told us a nice story. He somehow came to find out about Prabhupada's preaching center, 26 Second Avenue, and went there in 1968. And he came in the front entrance, and there was a table there with some books. And one of the books, or three of the books, were the three volumes of the Bhagavatam. He was astonished. He just didn't see anything like this. Prior to this, there was, he said, there was one copy of one translation of Bhagavatam from 1898 or something in some university library, and another Bhagavatam translation from 1930 or something in another university library. And it turned out the second one was just plagiarizing of the first one. but that was it. That was all there was. So Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. And he saw this, and there was a young man in the room, 26 2nd Avenue. Prabhupada was probably up in his apartment. So he was asking this young man, so these books are for sale? Yeah. How much are they? I don't know. So, and Swamiji, he's from India. Yes, he's from India. From which part of India? Is he from Bengal? What? Bengal. No, he's from India. It was quite clueless. anyway. Yeah, so... I've been spending most of my devotional life in Europe, one of the places that I haunt in Europe is Oxford, where Shonaka Rishi Prabhu, who was also here at the conference, and some of you met him, has, by his incredible brilliance, has brought into being a kind of institute which has become affiliated with Oxford University in an official way. And so many, many students now have come through the doors of that institute, and they all get lots of prasadam. And they also get sort of drenched with a bhakti mood, although it's an academic institute. Everyone who goes there, many scholars have come and spent periods of time under this institute's auspices. And they all go away saying, this was the most wonderful experience I ever had in academia. So that's one place where I hang my hat, or my danda, or my sika. and this academic institute, the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, it's called, has several research projects, and one of the projects, which Radhik Raman Prabhu, who was also here, and I think you, many or all of you, heard from him two nights ago. He and I together are leading this research project called the Bhagavata Purana Research Project. I don't know if he mentioned that. The first product of this project has been this book. This is what they call an edited volume. It's called The Bhagavata Purana, Sacred Text and Living Tradition, and it's been published by Columbia University Press in New York. It's a collection of 12 articles which are introducing the Bhagavatam thematically. For example, the general themes are, very quickly, reading the Bhagavatam, time and narrative, cosmology, ethics, commentary, sacred geography, theology, boundaries, dance, song, recitation, and text history. And this is going to be the sort of counterpart, you could say, of a second book which is coming out again with the same publisher. They told us this October it will be in print. This is an abridged translations from the Bhagavatam, selections from each of the 12 cantos. It was a painful process to select because you want to include everything, but you can't because they're limiting the size of the book. So this will be the Bhagavata Purana selected readings. And the translations are our own, that is Radhika Raman Prabhu and myself, together with summaries of all of the parts of the Bhagavatam which we could not include in the book. Would it be possible to get some water, drinking water? So just wanted to show this as something we do. Yeah, and these two books together are part of this greater project, the Bhagavata Purana Research. We could pass this around if you want to have a look at the contents, the table of contents. Okay. Okay. This more extensive research project is involving more scholars from India. You may say, but Prabhupada said there's no need of research. The research has already been done. What is this research you're doing? Well, there are several sorts of research. Thank you. Oh, I get two cups. Wow. Well, let's take that away. Thank you. Okay. I won't go into the details, but it's all part of... a lot of it is what so-called Indologists do. Indologists are a kind of subspecies of academics that you may not want to meet them. Some of them can be really strange. No, they're for the most part very, very pleasant people, but they have very strange preoccupations. Let us say like that. Anyway, I won't go into details. What we're interested in this evening and tomorrow evening and I think Wednesday evening is overviewing of the Bhagavatam. Usually in our classes, daily classes, Nityam Bhagavata Seva, we may take one verse and focus on it as Srila Prabhupada would do. And that is quite as it should be. In fact, in one lecture, Srila Prabhupada said, why only one day for one verse? You could easily spend 1 month studying one verse. And he was remembering how his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, had spent indeed 1 month discussing the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, the very first verse. Prabhupada said you could study each and every one of the verses of the Bhagavatam for 1 month each. And if it's 18,000 verses, then how long will that take? Well, we hear this and we may get a little discouraged. How am I ever going to progress in reading? That's one way of reading, but another way of reading is take a sort of wider perspective. And I find this helpful to appreciate, to draw out certain sort of bigger patterns and themes, and what I also call motifs in the Bhagavatam, which come in so many ways, so many permutations. And this can be very conducive to doing what we are invited to do in the third verse of the Bhagavatam. Pibata Bhagavatam rasam alayam muhuraho rasika bhuvi bhavuka. Pibata, drink Bhagavatam rasam alayam. Drink this reservoir of rasa, which is the Bhagavatam. So this is the spirit in which to appreciate. In other words, the author, we take it to be Vyasa, who is speaking these first three verses, or a few verses, the spirit in which to appreciate the Bhagavatam, to relish the Bhagavatam, is to be rasika. Rasika is, we have the French word connoisseur. You know this word? A connoisseur is literally one who knows, but it comes to mean one who has fine taste, refined taste, as a sense of what is good art, for example. In German you say Feinschmecker, right? Feinschmecker. Yeah. So this is to be our aspiration in reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, hearing the Bhagavatam, that through the process of hearing it, we become such rasikas, we become relishers of the Bhagavatam. So sort of simultaneously inviting us, it's calling, oh, all you rasikas. And then we may say, yeah, but that's not me. I can't really appreciate. No, you come also and you become a relisher. How? By hearing, and hearing among those who are relishing. And so one way to, there are so many ways we can relish the Bhagavatam. There's kind of no hard and fast rules. And one way I suggest is by doing sort of broad overviews to highlight certain patterns, and just to hear whole stories, because sometimes we'll read one verse at a time. You spend a month going through one chapter and, oh, what was it that happened? How come this is happening? What's going to happen? We get a little mixed up. Who's who? What's what? Can get complicated, especially when you get into Canto 9. There are all these kind of strange, complicated stories. Yeah. So sometimes I have done a little bit more extensive overviews. A few years back in Sydney, Australia, we did a 12-day overview of 12 cantos. And of course, you know there's a tradition of Bhagavat Saptaha, 7 days, which is modeled after the recitation by Shukadev Goswami to Maharaj Parikshit. And that way of presenting the Bhagavatam is, you may or may not know, become increasingly popular, not only in India, especially North India, but also outside of India, in the wider Indian diaspora. A lot of that is, of course, quite commercialized, and that's what Prabhupada quite strongly condemns in some of his purports in the first canto. But it's hard to classify I would say one has to be careful in generalizing, because some of these recitations are indeed done by very qualified persons with sincere motivations, not simply for economic gain or whatever. Right. How many of you have read the entire Bhagavatam at least once through? How many of you would like to read the Bhagavatam all the way through? What keeps us from doing that? Oh, no time, no time, right? And there are so many books. Everyone's writing books now. Now, how are we going to read the Bhagavatam when we have this book of essays about the Bhagavatam? We'll end up wasting time with that. Is that still circulating, book? Oh, I think you can. Okay, so I guess one of the sort of background motivations, you could say one of the basic aims of what I'm doing is try to encourage you to indeed go for the Bhagavatam, spend some more time with it. Now, and I'll mention one specific point about this, which it may sound a little sacrilegious, but I don't mean it that way. But what I see is that many times, indeed, devotees get a little bogged down because we feel we have to read it verse by verse by verse with all the purports. And reading the purports gets us bogged down. Well, okay, two points here. One is, Srila Prabhupada once said that basically everything that he has to tell us about the Bhagavatam, he tells us in the first two cantos. And so everything beyond that, he is many times reiterating points he's already made in connection with the specific verse or verses that he's dealing with. Now, he says that, and at the same time, it's not entirely true, because he does elaborate many interesting points, which he doesn't give in the first two cantos. So I'm not saying forget his purports after canto two. What I'm saying is that one way to read is just read the verses of a chapter quickly through. You get the cohesion, the sequence, and then you can go back and you can read purports. But to read the chapter sort of in one shot can be very very good for getting some momentum in the process of reading. Okay, before we sort of get started, I want to suggest also that let's do this in sort of seminar style, which means please feel free to interrupt and ask or comment. We can make it, you know, something of a discussion. I'm not so totally attached to hearing myself talk all the time. So, you know, if something comes up, please feel free to say, hey, what are you talking about, or whatever. Is that all right? Good. Okay. I have some notes here. I was going to mention, I did this in Australia. I've done here and there sometimes a few cantos. We're now doing online sort of once a month, and sort of one canto each session, a series going through the 12 cantos for devotees in China. So we have it arranged. One lady is translating into Mandarin, sort of back and forth, and then that's getting out to the far reaches of China. So that's kind of fun. Bhagavatam in Chinese is Bu Jie Wo Tan. Yeah. You never know what they're saying when they translate. Okay, so I want to enter into Canto 1, but before that, I want to alert you to some very broad themes in the Bhagavatam. Something we do in the introduction to this book that you're passing around. Before that, I should mention we have divided these essays in the book into two parts. The first part is called The World of the Bhagavatam, and the second part is The Bhagavatam in the World. Well, that's not meant just to be a play on words, but the idea is that the world of the Bhagavatam is the world of a certain way of understanding the world which the Bhagavatam presents. And of course, the aim of the Bhagavatam is to invite us, the hearers and readers, to enter into that world and then to make, by our entry, to make this world that world, so that there's kind of no difference between the two. And so the second part, the Bhagavata in the world, is seeing how this text has affected the world in so many different ways, including art, including music, in other ways, in drama, performances of all sorts. The last chapter in that book is the history of how the Bhagavatam has come to the West. There's a whole history, which of course culminates in a wonderful way with Srila Prabhupada's publication, translation and purports, and the very wide distribution of the Bhagavatam. So there are some themes, and some of these you'll hear and you'll say, well, of course, that's there, I know that. But just to kind of point to it, sometimes it's helpful, it alerts us. So one theme, and I have eight listed here in the context of the world of the Bhagavatam. First is Dharma and Bhakti. So what is the relation between Dharma and Bhakti? We hear from the very beginning, Dharma projita kaitavotra parama. The kaitava dharma is praujita, it is rejected. All kinds of cheating dharma. But then, does it reject dharma? By no means. Sa vai pungsang paro dharma yato bhaktir at hokshaje. The best dharma is adhokshaja bhakti, ahaituki bhakti. And that's explained in chapter 2. But my point here is that the whole Bhagavatam is showing how this idea of dharma, whatever that is, you can translate it in so many ways, and bhakti, whatever that is, how they are sort of interwoven to bring bhakti to the center, but with a kind of foundation in dharma. It's not throwing out dharma. Dharma is always there in the background. Another theme is renunciation and bhakti. So many stories in the Bhagavatam are about some sort of renunciation. So many kings give up their kingdoms, and that's going to be the main story of Canto 1, Maharaj Parikshit gives up his kingdom to hear the Bhagavatam. A third theme is time's multiple dimensions, the complexities of time, the reality or unreality of time, and most importantly, going beyond time, transcending time. How does one go from this world of time beyond this world of time? Karma versus Leela. They both have something in common, or seem to have, namely doing something. When you act, there's some sort of story about acting. I did this, and then I did that, and then I did something else, and that's the end of the story. And then life came to an end. End of story. And then Leela, we read Krishna Leela, especially in the 10th canto. Krishna appeared, and then he met this demon, and he killed that demon, and then he met these devotees, and he danced with those devotees. This is all Leela. How are these related? Sometimes Krishna Leela is referred to as Krishna Karma, as the activities of the Lord. Then there's the theme of human weakness and divine grace. Canto 6, chapters 1 through 3, especially the story of Ajamila, Ajamila's weakness, and then the divine grace that comes from his sort of accidentally chanting the name Narayana, which is taken, although he had a different idea. What he was chanting was sufficient to save him from the noose of Yamaraj. Another theme is the power, beauty, and danger of speech. The Bhagavatam as a whole is powerful speech, and it is purifying speech. And it is poetry. Sometimes devotees kind of ignore this aspect of the Bhagavatam. It is poetry, which means it is language which has been, how to say, sort of wound into a tight ball of meaning. It's like the coil of a electric motor. You spin it next to a magnet. I don't know how it works. Coil of wire. It generates electricity. So the language of the Bhagavatam. It's first of all, Sanskrit is a very compact sort of language. When you learn Sanskrit, you have to first learn how to sort of unpack the words from each other, because they've been sort of packed together by sandhi. You have to unpack them and then find out their basic forms and so on. So and then add to that it's poetry. And what is poetry? It's taking language and it's using language in so many rich ways. Not only with denotation, but also with connotation. And third, and most importantly in poetry, according to classical Sanskrit poetic theory, suggestion. The famous example of this from Indian aesthetic theory is Gangayam Gosha. Gangayam Goshaha means a village on the river Ganga. What? Village on the Ganga? That sounds like a village that's going to float away real fast. Well, no, it can't possibly mean that literally. So it must be meaning it figuratively. It must be a village on the bank of the Ganges. Yes, but that does not exhaust the significance of the expression. The third level of appreciation of Gangayam Gosha is you think of a village on the bank of the Ganga and you think, oh, there must be cool breezes in this village, and so it must be a pleasant place. And so that's the suggestion which comes from that simple expression. So poetry does that. And that's one reason why we should all be learning Sanskrit diligently so that we can appreciate some of these things which otherwise tend to get missed in translation. Just joking. But actually, Prabhupada wanted us to be attentive to the Sanskrit by giving us the word-for-word translations. And there's lots of richness there also. Okay, another sort of theme in the world of the Bhagavatam is social identity, social roles, and also role reversals. Demons turn out to be devotees, lowly persons turn out to be exalted persons, like that. And so the rigidity of social positions is always being shaken in the Bhagavatam, and in that respect the Bhagavatam is quite, dare I say, postmodern. And the eighth of these themes, especially in this section, the world of the Bhagavatam, is how to become a Bhagavata, that is, a devotee. Because Bhagavata means one who is related to Bhagavan, to the Lord. And so many accounts in the Bhagavatam are of Bhagavatas. And so why do we, you know, bother hearing about them? So that we can become inspired that we may follow them, follow their example, and become ourselves Bhagavatas. Okay, those are some broad themes. Any questions about any of that so far? Yes.
Are these themes considered to be comprehensive or just some part of the
These are major themes that we found to be especially noteworthy. No doubt there are others. There are also what I call, not exactly themes, but motifs. What's the difference? It's hard to make a sharp line between the two, but an example of a motif which I found comes again and again in the Bhagavatam is what I call reception. Reception means someone comes to your home and you receive them. And how do you receive them? You might welcome them, and we hear about Vedic ways to welcome someone. Or you might be in a bad mood and you might say, don't, you know, go away. And in the Bhagavatam, when someone's in a bad mood or whatever it is in a reception, there are huge consequences. Huge consequences. And when somebody is well received, it's wonderful. And these receptions are happening, and many permutations. And it's sort of like, you know, you can cut a pie in infinite number of ways, so you may find other sorts of themes. Of course, the Bhagavatam itself defines its own themes at the end of Canto 2. There are 10 themes. Atta sarga visargascha. Atasargo visargas chastanam poshanam uttaya manvantare shanukata nirodho muktir ashraya. And those themes are certainly there, but what we found in myself, Radhika Raman, in our work, how to make this more accessible for persons who are not sort of in the world of the Puranas in general, what to speak of the Bhagavatam. We found it helpful to talk about this other sort of group. And of course, there's also overlap in all of this. If we talk about ashraya, that means shelter. The Lord is the ultimate shelter. So that's talking about bhakti, of course. Yeah, and so on. You could probably find other parallels and overlaps. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
Just wanted to confirm the authenticity of the description of Bhagavatam. You know, I heard that Bhagavatam is compared to the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna. It is said that the first two cantos of Bhagavatam are like lotus feet of Krishna. So, and,
yeah.
The crown is like 11 and 12 cantos. The lotus feet is like 10 cantos. So is it there any Sanskrit authenticity in our ISKCON or Gaudiya Vaishnavism?
If I remember correctly, this is a description given by Sridhar Swami, and Srila Prabhupada mentions it, I believe also. Yes, the first two cantos are the two lotus feet of the Lord, and then you sort of work yourself up, and then the tenth canto is the lotus face of the Lord. And that's a nice way of understanding the structure of the Bhagavatam. Well, we won't have a whole lot of time, but we might, yeah, we'll see. We might, I might suggest other ways of looking at the structure of the Bhagavatam. Not to say, you know, this one's better than that one, but certainly this is helpful for us. Yeah. Yeah, the Bhagavatam is very, it's multi-dimensional. Yes.
Not to get caught up in studying in a more scholarly way and dive more into the devotional aspect of Srimad.
Ah, yes. How not to get caught up in what I got caught up in. No, I mean, your question is good. Well, you just first of all, I would put it like this. We should not be confused. We want to be devotees. We want to be bhaktas. We want to be Vaishnava. We want to be Bhagavata. And whatever scholarship might be there may sometimes be useful. In furthering our devotion, and to the extent that it's not, we just don't worry about it. And so it comes back to the principle, anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya varjana, accepting what's favorable and rejecting what's not favorable for devotion. And this will be... That rule is given an extremely general sense. Who decides, or how does one decide what's favorable, what's not favorable? A lot of the decision we have to make is we have to make it ourselves. Prabhupada gives it so many indications what's favorable. Well, hear from devotees, don't hear from non-devotees. Read progressively from canto. Beginning with Canto 1, work your way through the first 9 cantos and then Canto 10 and so on. I have a kind of funny story about that. We have one scholar in Oxford, very nice man, very helpful, very senior. He's now retired professor of theology, and he's really more than anyone the person who opened the door of Oxford University for us to develop this center, which is now affiliated with it. And so he's a very widely read scholar. He's familiar with certain aspects of Hinduism, Vaishnavism. He has written some. He's interested in comparative theology, like that. His own tradition is Christian, Anglican. But Shonaga wanted to show his gratitude for his help. He gave him a complete set of Bhagavatams as a gift. And so this gentleman was reading, and some weeks later, I guess, he met Shonaga. And he's kind of a funny fellow. Sometimes he can be quite funny. He said, you know, I was reading in the first canto, and I was reading along, and I read in one of Swami Prabhupada's purports that one should absolutely not jump to the 10th canto. One should read systematically, cantos 1 through 9. I read that, and when I read that, well, I just couldn't resist. I jumped immediately to the 10th canto. Of course, Prabhupada also, you know, provided that option by writing the Krishna book, because he wanted that to be available. He wasn't sure how long he would live. He wanted to make sure 10th canto would be available. Yeah, how not to get sort of distracted by scholarship or whatever, scholarly perspectives. Yeah, we read devotionally, and that means reading with devotees. One scholar who actually argues that we should be reading religious texts religiously. He wrote a book on this subject. He called it Religious Reading. And he said there's religious reading and there's consumer reading. And most of us, most of the time, read something to get something out of it for ourselves, and then just when we've gotten it, you throw the book away, kind of thing. But religious reading, devotional reading, is you read it, and then you read it again, and then you read it again, and you keep on reading it. And because it is what it is, you keep getting more and more enriched. And so with the Bhagavatam, you come to the end of the 12th canto. What to do now? Well, there's two things you can do. One is you go on to Chaitanya Charitamrita, which can be read as a commentary to the Bhagavatam. Or you can go back to the beginning of Canto 1 and start over. It's like keep going in a cycle. Or you can do both. Yes,
Sitaram. Would it be useful to define and elaborate on what Srila Prabhupada meant by scrutinizingly studying?
Yeah.
We don't want to be scholarly, but we do. I mean,
yeah.
Scholarly could just mean, in one sense, could be very deeply scrutinizingly studying it.
Yeah.
So there's aspects, it seems, that we're supposed to do it partially scholarly.
Yeah, thank you. That's a nice point also. Scrutinize, Prabhupada liked that word. Read scrutinizingly. He also said, discuss the Bhagavatam from all angles of vision. What does that mean? Well, It means we can, you know, find so many different ways of appreciating and so many ways of discussing. And he also, I don't know, once or more than once, he said, discuss it threadbare. Just keep discussing, you know, until it's... although it's inexhaustible, but just keep going with it. As getting back to scrutinizingly, I put together one day a little list of what I call bells. We say, you know, oh, that rings a bell, right? So I put together a list of 8 types of bells that might get rung in your head as you read. And so this kind of, yeah, it's a kind of active reading as opposed to passive. I would suggest that, I would say that's kind of the broad distinction between passively kind of waiting until something, you know, wakes me up, and actively looking and drawing out and having perhaps a question that you're looking for answers for in the text. I've sometimes wondered if we couldn't develop in our practice, our daily routine of Bhagavatam classes in the morning, a culture of everyone comes to class having already read prior to the class the verse and the purport of the particular. Because, I see some nodding heads. Because our tendency is we come in and we're just sort of, so, what are you going to tell me? You know, sort of empty heads. And sometimes it can be a challenge for the speaker, sort of like, hello, is anybody there? Some bodies are there, but anything here? But if one reads and a little bit thinks, you know, it can be done in 5 minutes or less, one reflects a little about what it is that's going to be discussed. That could lead to much more rich engagement with the subject, because one will have already been churning something about it in advance. So that would also be a kind of scrutinizing reading. Okay, good. So, well, maybe we should get into Canto 1. All right, what do you think? Where does the Bhagavatam begin? This is a trick question. Where does the Bhagavatam begin? Everyone, I just warned you, it's a trick question, so nobody dares to venture an answer.
Vedanta Sutra.
Oh, okay. Well, that could be one way of saying how the Bhagavatam begins. Thank you. Any other suggestions? Madhaji?
It's not in chronological order, for one thing.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of goes back and forth. Like, it's starting with Sutta Goswami, is that right? And Shona Rishi, but they're talking in past tense. Although it didn't seem to have happened, some of the events.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's important. Technically, you said it starts with Sutta Goswami, but the first 3 verses, it doesn't say anything such and such uvacha. It just starts Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We don't know who speaks those. The assumption is it must be Vyasa, since we understand it's Vyasa who compiles the Bhagavatam. But, you can't really insist on that. It's a kind of anonymous three verses in the beginning. But then, yes, it's Sutta and it's Shonaka, and it seems to be pointing to the past. And, well, the simple point I wanted to make is that in an important sense, the Bhagavatam doesn't begin until chapter 1 of Canto 2. Because that's when Shuka, who throughout the Bhagavatam is simply referred to as Shuka, he's never referred to as Shukadeva, nor as Shukadeva Goswami, but he's always Shuka. In any case, we say Shukadeva. When he begins to answer the question of Maharaj Parikshit, which Maharaj Parikshit has posed in the very end of Canto 1. And so, what is Canto 1? It's a kind of a grand preparation. It's setting the stage. It's in musical terms, you might call it an overture to the grand symphony, which is the Bhagavatam. And I use that term overture because it suggests this this aspect of presenting or introducing themes, which then get expanded in the course of the later cantos, and then is brought out in full in Canto 10 and 11. That's a very complicated mandala. Wow. Nice. Okay. Well, let's see. Oh, it's already after 8. Anyway, let's see what happens.